You're listening to The God Journey, a place where people thinking outside the box of organized religion can share thoughts and conversation along the journey. Here are your hosts and fellow travelers, Wayne Jacobson and Brad Cummings.
I'm Brad Cummings.
And I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And here we are with another edition of The God Journey.
Well, it's been a couple of weeks because we were up in Visalia, did a couple extra tapings. So
yeah, how about that? It aired right at the Oscars times. Did you watch the Oscars last night?
Couldn't have planned that any better, could we, if we'd have tried?
Yeah, we didn't try, but I thought that was a great plan.
I almost never watch the Oscars, to be honest. But my son was home a little bit, and he wanted to watch the lead-in. So we're kind of Jon Stewart fans, so we... We tried to root for him a little bit. Yeah, we did watch
him. He was struggling at the beginning there.
Struggled and found his stride later in the show, maybe. Probably not the best format for him. Need a little more high energy than he is, I think, for that kind of event. But I'm the last of all the TV critics, so.
Well, I thought it was fantastic. I was excited that Crash won for Best Picture because in our last podcast, Kelly's first response was, why didn't you mention anything about Crash? Because we talked about that for weeks. I thought that was an absolutely brilliant movie.
Really? For weeks?
Yeah, we did.
That's a long time. We didn't even talk about Narnia that long.
I know. I haven't been captured by a movie. It took me by surprise, and it did what I think great filmmaking does. You end up looking at that and just go like, man, I would love to distance myself from any kind of racial prejudices if I'm not like that. And that movie just sort of spun everything backwards and forwards in a way you just kind of went, you know what? I wonder how I'd respond if I was in a situation like that. And it just, I don't know, it was very provocative and I thought very inviting of a measure of conviction of just going like, maybe I don't know my own heart as well as I think.
Ah, that is good filmmaking.
And I just, I don't know, I was very impacted by it. I thought it was brilliant. And so I you remembered last podcast, you'd asked the question, you know, what great films out there? That's one. If you haven't seen it, please go see it. It is well worth the price of admission and popcorn.
It's kind of raw and a bit edgy, but it really asks some provocative questions about how we consider race. And I do think it's easy for us to either put on a black hat on somebody else or a white hat on us, and we see things and, yeah, we're great, we're wonderful. But I think you're right. I think that movie really says, gosh, how would I respond in those situations? And am I as quick to rise to justice for people who have felt oppressed by the way culture has been? And growing up as a white male in America, we've grown up with a certain amount of privilege. There's no doubt about it. And that's not always available to everybody else. And then how do we really feel about that? And what are we doing in the culture to make a difference there? And it does provoke those kinds of questions. It did for me.
Yeah, I loved it. I thought the Oscars were just an absolute interesting year to watch because there was a lot of sort of, you know, social justice, trying to make a statement sort of films out there. It was Hollywood trying to be its edgy best. And then to have Jon Stewart as the MC, the host for it, I kind of went, gosh, he's on wrong footing here. He's not exactly in the whole liberal Hollywood camp. He tends to be a little bit on the more conservative pundit side.
I don't know. So he's out there.
But at times, I mean, it seemed like in his opening monologue, there was that whole struggle of he kind of painted Hollywood as this, you know, liberal bastion about ready to fall into the sea, kind of should be judge dynamic. And to some degree, it's like even George Clooney made fun of the fact that, well, yeah, you know, that's almost by purpose and design. And what was so interesting is I just sort of felt like I couldn't take my normal stereotypes. I couldn't watch it with the same. I mean, Brokeback Mountain winning as many as it did. You sort of had, you know, this is the year of the gay cowboy, all right? And this may bother some
folks. I'm glad I didn't spend so much time with the show as you did.
But it was so interesting to me because when the director Ang Lee won for Best Director, he gave an incredible, intelligent, meaningful response of what I think the heart of the film was, which wasn't trying to promote just gay cowboys. It was about love and the difficulty of being misunderstood and what do you do with what's going on. And I certainly am not excited about gay cowboys, and I haven't even wanted to watch the film.
Wouldn't people have a problem with saying that, you know, seeing gay cowboys, particularly people that come from our particular background, are not going to use the word love with gay cowboys. We're going to use a word like lust because we know biblically it's wrong and Scripture is very clear about it. And for most of us, it's not our temptation. It's not where we struggle. So, I mean, just even call it love. Isn't that kind of a I don't know.
I mean, it was so interesting. My day started out with reading the morning paper, and then I looked at the little headline of how this Christian school decided to publicly disown Michelle Williams.
Who, San Diego, right?
Yeah. I mean, they publicly disowned her. I don't need to name the school.
Nope.
But they publicly disowned her because of the role that she played in Brokeback Mountain. And I sat there going like, okay, and what has that accomplished? You know, it's like, great.
It's purified the school.
Oh, yeah. We have nothing to do with it. It's like, we didn't produce this student. And it's like, you know, it's like, how could you? Yes, she was your student. Nothing's ever going to change the fact that she did come up through your school. And is she now to be vilified because, she, as an actress, she took a part in this? Is she out there trying to champion gay cowboys? Is that her agenda? I don't know anyone who made the film. I have no personal relationship with any of them to be able to assess any of their intent,
that's good to
motive,
know.
And I look at this, and I just sat there going like, I found myself on a different side of the whole joking dynamic going like, you know what, maybe I've misjudged this film. Maybe I've misjudged the agenda behind here. Maybe, you know, maybe I haven't. But the reality is I sat there going like, you know what, I think Jesus might have a much different response to the people than we've jokingly kind of made of it.
Such as?
Well, I think he would probably, in the midst of, if that is a genuine struggle two people are having, I think Jesus would be there trying to genuinely walk them through that struggle. I don't think he would just amputate them.
Well, that would be true. He wouldn't be casting the first stone, as we say.
And I don't think he would sit there and want to publicly disown an actress because of her. I just sort of feel like Jesus has much of a more engaged dialogue with people stuck in sin to try to find their true heart and where he's at and lead them out of that than the just judging of whether they're right or wrong. And I think I just think at times the church and the Christian culture has a tendency, without any real knowledge of where people are at, to on the surface level look at things and to draw clear black and white lines of sort of in and out, right and wrong, and we dismiss a lot of things. I mean,
but I'm not sure that's all that's going on with this movie. I think there is the perception by many of us that Hollywood continues to push the limits of propriety and trying to push for acceptance of things in the culture that 30 years ago we wouldn't talk about. And quite honestly, there are people that don't want to talk about them today and see movies like Brokeback Mountain and others that Transamerica maybe trying to push on the rest of the culture and acceptance for lifestyles that are clearly not biblical, clearly not in the reference of how God's created us and what he wants us to be. And yet, I agree with you, it is in the realm of people's struggles. So I think there's one thing about how do we help people who are struggling with various temptations and sins may be very different than trying to celebrate it on a screen.
Oh, I agree with that. It's just interesting. I found myself watching the Academy Awards and being, frankly, a little more sympathetic in hearing a cry for acceptance, as opposed to thinking that then means I'm now condoning a bunch of things that I do know to be wrong lifestyles and destructive choices. So I found myself in a different spot, and I went, you know what? It's interesting. I think
your email address again is?
Yeah, keep those cards and letters coming. I just found myself looking at a little bit of the history of how I think the church has initiated a culture war in which, to some degree, we have perhaps been the aggressor in terms of our judgments. And I wonder if we haven't pushed a creative community into a place of needing to kind of flaunt its sense of stuff. And, you know, maybe there are people there that really are pushing an agenda that they just want to somehow, you know, make tolerance the dynamic. And guess what? I don't buy into that. But I do think there are folks out there that are part of the whole creative community. They're just saying, look, I am needing of acceptance as a human being.
That's what we've not been good at, I think. I mean, we talked about this a couple podcasts ago about the Peacemaker thing. It's easy to throw around hate the sin and love the sinner, but it's really difficult to communicate acceptance and respect for a life that may be involved in a sin that we don't approve of. I think religious people have a difficult time loving what we don't condone.
Yeah.
When I do training for HIV/AIDS workers mission on the mission field, I usually start with an opening like, "Hi, my name's Wayne Jacobson, and I'm a recovering Pharisee." And they all laugh because they think, yeah, it's really cute. And then I say, you know what? I've just confessed something worse to you than if I'd confessed to you that I'd been a male prostitute in New York City, which, by the way, is the only kind of prostitute I could be since I'm male. But then they laugh at that because they think that's a funny joke. The fact is, we don't believe that our religious arrogance puts us further out there in the rank of sin, if you want to rank it, because Paul did. Paul said, as a Pharisee of Pharisees, he was the chiefest of sinners. He was full of blasphemy and violent aggression and a persecutor of the church. So I think that to have this sense of how do we love what we don't condone is something that Jesus had no problem doing. But I think religion is purely conflicted with that. We don't know how to love people who are caught in lifestyles and choices and behaviors we don't condone.
Yeah, and I think the reality is it's, we're not even asking that question. And that's the thing that really bothers me.
I find more and more people are. I honestly do. I think a lot of our political debate, I've been doing Bridge Builders now for about almost 20 years. That's the work I do in public education to reconcile religious differences or cultural conflicts. And in fact, I'm off to D.C. this week. I'm going to be on C-SPAN, I think, Friday night, 7 o'clock Eastern, on a show called Close Up. I think it's playing this week. It could play next. We're releasing a brochure that I helped broker last summer. We brought together people from the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network. There you go. That's got red flags all over it. But also we had conservative Christians there and people from the National School Boards Association attorneys. And we were trying to broker an agreement that we could say, how can school districts deal with the fact that a lot of people are discriminated against or harassed on sexual orientation or gender identity terms? And that's not just gay people. I mean, we grew up in locker rooms.
There's
and
bullying on every level.
We know that a lot of you don't have to be gay to be called names that are definitely off the charts in terms of making people feel belittled and demeaned. And I think this brochure is, how do schools deal with that kind of discrimination? Because, yeah, disproportionate number of suicides at that age, acts of violence come from kids who are being mocked and harassed and teased as gay, whether they are or not. How do we deal with that issue in public schools without having to celebrate homosexuality, without having to undermine the faith community that says, hold it, there's moral issues involved here. We don't want the school saying there isn't. We don't want the school celebrating gay pride days any more than they would celebrate Christian pride days. I mean, there's got to be a place where public school is fair for everybody. And so we're going to release it. We finished that brochure. It's going to be released on Thursday. We're going to do some national press at the National Press Club. I don't know what that's about, man. And I don't know how I get in places like that, to be honest. And then we're going to do this C-SPAN interview, and it should be interesting because I'll be there with the executive director of GLSEN, the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network. And we'll be there with the Christian Legal, the Christian Educators Association. They'll be there as well. And I find this process engaging, to put people in a room. And I have never found, as a mediator working with bridge builders or trainer, that I've done a lot of training of groups, I'll often walk out of trainings I've just done on how Christian parents feel about homosexuality and how it is that we could deal with it in public schools and still make it fair for everyone and not have to feel like Christians are no longer welcome there or their worldview is being undermined there. And people are pretty clear. I walk out of a meeting like they're pretty clear where my worldview is and that I think homosexuality is outside the scope of what God said is in his will for us. But I can't tell you, Brad, how many times I've walked out of a meeting like that and had someone or two people come up to me and ask me if they could go to lunch. And I'd go to lunch with them, find out they're either a gay couple or they're both gay. Sometimes they've got AIDS or whatever. And they'll ask me to say, you know what, I grew up in that little painted chair in Sunday school. And when I couldn't reconcile what I was feeling in terms sexually inside with what the religious environment said I was sin and conflicted. I left all that, and I've left God and haven't been anywhere near him. But I know you don't agree with the way I'm living, but can you tell me about the God that you know? And I've just found it interesting. You can have rational dialogue with people you disagree with as long as you show them some basis of respect or acceptability as a person, that I'll still accept you as a person. I may disagree with you. I may think what you're doing is sin. Hey, you may think my belief in God is sin in that sense. You may think that's wrong. But I find when you're not trying to push people into your lifestyle, you accept them where they're at, They'll even give you the dialogue. I've had many chances to talk to people about God and how God loves folks, and that if homosexuality is sin, it's not God pointing the finger, judgment going to hell. It's God saying, I want to help you. I want to restore what's broken here to make it right again. And to me, that's what sin is, and that's what judgment is. Judgment isn't God just whacking things with big sticks. Judgment is God setting things right. And when the trees are dancing and the hills are clapping in Psalms, it's always because God's coming to judge. And it's not a fearful, scary thing. It's God's coming to set right. And I think what the cross did for us is that it allows God to set right things that were broken in us. And somebody who's struggling with being gay is no different than someone struggling with being an arrogant religionist. It's all the same thing that God wants to sort out in us. But I know the religious community doesn't see that.
No, they don't. And I just, I mean, you sit there for the best song of the year. You know, it's Hard Out There for a Pimp.
I told you,
you know,
we don't need to bring that up.
Like, my lids. I just laugh because they're in the acceptance speech. One of the guys bumps in and says, I just want to thank Jesus. And I just kind of went,
yeah, and I didn't think that
what?
Was funny because I heard the song and I didn't even think it was a song to start out with. This whole rap thing, man, I don't get.
But I sat there going like, okay,
yeah, guy thanks Jesus
is it possible for the sincerity of that guy to say, yeah. And I just go like, okay, do I understand the rap culture? No, I'm not a rap guy. But you know, is it hard out there for a pimp? I sat there going like, you know, I imagine it really is, you know,
yeah. And some of us want it to be a little bit complicated,
yes,
for him.
Again, but in my weird brain, I sat there going like, you know, if Jesus found himself walking that street and bumping into that guy, it seemed like Jesus had an amazing capacity to communicate to people that he had genuine love and interest in who they were. And it wasn't so much an issue of the rightness and wrongness of their behaviors or their lifestyle. He didn't start there. He start with a genuine, I love you. And I mean, Jesus was a friend of sinners. Somehow they must have felt something real and genuine about his interest in them as people for them to want to hang out with him. I just know that it, all of a sudden when your conscience gets smitten and you feel like, oh, I am worse than the worst, all of a sudden, why would you want to hang out with that person? You must be feeling something that most people are not getting as the message from the church. I mean, most people, if you were to say, you know, God's watching you, they don't go, awesome.
Yeah.
They feel like, oh, no,
yeah,
I'm in trouble.
It's like the cop behind you on the freeway.
Yeah, exactly. They're like, oh, no.
Now I'm driving safe, but it's no fun, and I'm not getting anywhere. But
and,
yeah.
And I just think that is such a profound mischaracterization of God.
Well, isn't it? I mean, I think as a religionist, as a Pharisee, when I talk about being a recovering Pharisee, I think one of the things that identifies a Pharisee is that you're always looking down on people. You look at yourself as, man, I'm doing the right stuff. I'm working hard. I got it together. And people who are not working as hard at you to get it right. And worst of all, people enjoying sin are just the things that tick Pharisees off the most. Because we see people as co-conspirators in their sin. The whole argument over gay rights in America is gay is a choice. It's not, you know, and the people who are gay, I've never met a gay person. I've talked to hundreds of them. I've never met a gay person that says, you know, I chose this. I was growing up as a little kid and I thought, you know what, I'd really like to be gay because gay would be more fun in this culture. That's their temptation. Where they got it, I don't know. I don't know where I got mine. I don't know where my tendency to be an arrogant Pharisee or my tendency to be impatient or angry or want to choke my wife for putting crown molding up on the house this weekend. I don't know where those things come from. I really don't. I'm not saying I chose my temptations. I just know that when Scripture identifies something as sin, it means it's something that's broken in me that I can't fix, that only he can fix. Jesus, when he looked at the world, Matthew 9, he looked at the world as harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. Now, that's a very different view than co-conspirator in sin, is to say, ah, that's people that have been sucked in by evil, damaged by some brokenness in their life. And I think that's what allowed, and that's part of what I do in the training I do with these HIV/AIDS missionary folks, is move from the compassion of a Pharisee, which is basically condescension. It's not compassion at all. To the compassion of a fellow struggler and traveler and loving what we love, not because we condone their sin or their behavior or their attitude, but we love what we love because we see people who are caught in sin as broken, harassed, helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. That allows us, I think, to access lives a little more like Jesus did.
Yeah, you know, I just find, you know, having stepped away from the institutional structure, I have found myself stepping closer to people's actual lives, and I've found it a whole lot easier to enter into that dialogue because I don't have the same lines that I've, you know, I've got to sort of champion. And I just, I don't understand, is it just something that God is doing in me, or is this is part of the culture that we've inherited with the religious institution? I don't know, and I can't answer for everybody, but I do know that it was interesting having laughed at all the jokes that are out there and having sort of dismissed things out of hand. I watched the Oscars from a different standpoint of going like, gosh, maybe I'm missing a cry that is coming up through this creative media entertainment community that is looking for some acceptance, looking to say, look, I'm misunderstood, I'm hurting, as opposed to just so much championing wrong lifestyles.
You know, I could probably buy into that a little more if they weren't coming into their carpet in their million-dollar dresses and jewelry and all that stuff. I mean, this, when you're growing up in L.A., come on, this is a very privileged class of people who make it into the beautiful people, who have these pageants of hedonism to themselves. I'm going to look at part of that going, this is just sick. I don't hear a cry for hunger from them. Now, maybe some of the themes they're dealing with, you're dealing with broken lives. I hear some of that, but...
But you know what? I taught tennis in Malibu for years. That's how I paid my way through college. And
really?
I actually spent a lot of time...
With some of those beautiful people?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's not drop names, but...
And the reality is what I saw is I saw behind all the glitz and the glamour and the place of prestige, you know, of fame and fortune, I saw some of the saddest, aching people inside that they would look at me and my little buddy, who's another Christian friend, and they would look at us and say, you know what? You have nothing of what we have, and yet you're happier than we are. What's up with that? And the genuine conversations that would develop were just extraordinary, because I could sit there and say, no, I don't have all the stuff you have. My bank account, it doesn't even register with what you spend in an afternoon.
Right.
And
on
yet,
tennis lessons.
Yeah.
That you don't get.
But the reality is I did. I feel like there is a genuine cry there amidst all the stuff behind all the veneer. When they go to, you know, to home at night and they put their head on the pillow, their ache is pretty common in terms of what is the same thing down perhaps in the hood.
I don't doubt that. I don't doubt that at all. But I think the way they put on the glitz and the glamour and the fact that some of these movies do have an agenda, and I don't know, obviously, people who make any particular movie, but I think there is an agenda in Hollywood to push some cultural boundaries that you say maybe Christians are the aggressor in this culture war. I think we've become that. But I think in the initial stages, culture ran pretty much the way we wanted it to. We controlled all the rules and regs, and pretty much up till 62 in this 1962 in this country, all our laws were pretty much set on the Christian morality kinds of things that came from Europe and were part of our early history as a culture. And in the 60s, that began to change, and groups that were feeling oppressed by that Christian morality began to push back. And now we see Christian groups pushing back. So there's this re-pushing back, because now I think we're feeling marginalized by the way culture has gone. And if you would say, gosh, culture has improved in the last 30 years, 40 years, you might say, well, that's a deal. But in some ways, and I think some ways culture has progressed, I think in other ways, levels of violence, things that go on in our culture, the degradation of sin, more that you can access more easily, sexually explicit images. I mean, I do think in some ways culture is on a downturn as well. And I do think Hollywood has some responsibility to bear in that.
I do too. I just wonder, I think the thing that I'm perhaps fundamentally questioning is, what really is our response? Yes, there's been the tit for tat. There's been the escalation of the culture war. I just don't think we're going to gain any ground by buying into the demonization of those that disagree with us or perhaps are actively championing something else. I don't think I gain anything by trying to demonize them and shoot them with whatever missiles of judgment I've got.
I agree, but I think this is a difficult sell for folks that are just listening. We just even popped up on our message board this morning while we were talking about this podcast from Glenn, a little note that I think is pretty intriguing because we didn't get any feedback from our Blessed Are the Peacemakers podcast.
Yeah, that would have been like a lead balloon.
Yeah, so we're going to do it again until we get it right. No, actually, but Glenn Wright said, I noticed nobody started a thread about Blessed Are the Peacemakers. Maybe that's because we're still mulling it over. I know it made me think. I believe it made me a bit uncomfortable to consider being a peacemaker like Brad and Wayne described. Kind of goes against human nature, maybe, or maybe just my westernized culture. Like I said in the podcast, we here in the Western world generally have the right to say any stupid thing we want to say, the whole freedom of speech press thing. But I was reminded of Paul's statements in Romans 14, 1 Corinthians 9, where he basically says he may well have certain rights to do certain things, but he would not use his freedom to destroy others. I like that. And then he says, this is one of those uncomfortable podcasts where I know the discomfort was from the Lord, because although I know what is right, my flesh wants to argue for my own rights. Man, now that's poignant. That may be how people are responding to this one, too, because we're really talking about how it is that we're in the world and love folks in a way that doesn't diminish our passion for morality, but actually sees people as captive and wanting to love them in ways and acknowledge them in ways that opens the conversation, doesn't slam the door shut.
Yeah, and you know, I think the typical approach that the church has had is like, okay, maybe I'm not going to outright judge, but now I'm going to have compassion and come to someone who, you know, obviously I conclude they're broke and they need to be fixed. And so I'm going to come, and in my compassion, I'm going to come fix them. That, for so many people, is just as offensive.
Oh, that's a huge turnoff.
Okay?
Absolutely.
And so I sit here, and I just go like, okay, if we're going to have any redemptive effect, being salt and light in this world, look, I don't expect it to get just better and better and brighter and brighter. It is getting darker and darker in many respects. And I'm going like, okay, so how do I have that salt and light effect? And I do think that perhaps the starting point that many people have is just an ineffectual one. I mean, okay, I'm going to disown this person for having taken part in this movie. And that accomplishes what? All right.
Yeah.
Okay. So you've absolved yourself of any association. And that was really necessary because we were all looking at you saying, oh, you were part of the Brokeback team. That, you know, that school had nothing to do with it.
Well, it's a little bit like, I mean, that's pretty graphic portrayal of what Jesus faced when he was hanging out with, quote, tax gatherers and sinners, which tax gathering was really bad back then. It's, you know, just because you work for the IRS today doesn't mean you're evil. But back then it was a different deal. And it just angered the religious folks. How dare you do that? How dare you spend time with people who are in sin? And I think it is the tendency of religion to see people as on our team or not on our team. And if you're on our team, you know, all the accolades and yeah, patting you on the back. If you're not on our team, if you're doing something that we consider wrong or evil or against what we're about in the culture, then our response has been often to vilify those or patronizing, like you say, patronizing, let me offer you help to get out of your horrible, miserable life. When they see us as Pharisees living that horrible, miserable life, one of the things I'm noticing about people who are escaping this box of religious obligation, whether or not they're attending a Sunday thing or not, but this box of religious obligation is the fact that I do see some of the things we're talking about becoming a real growing edge for people. Now they want to be in the world. And now that they have felt some of that because they're not conforming anymore, they've felt some of that religious oppression themselves. I think that's part of making them more effective in the world. I really do. Because I'm not sure religion knows how to reach out to the world. I mean, the things we do are bizarre. I mean, we do crusades and rallies that hopefully get the unsafe to come, and then you've got to tell all the church people to come so it looks like a success. Or there's a new 40-day prayer thing launched out now, or, you know, 40 days of fasting and prayer because we're going to bring this revival to America. My goodness, if I had $10 for every time I had that, for every minute spent praying for a revival, you know, I could retire and probably would.
You know, I do think at the end of the day, there is the challenging question of, Lord, how are you calling me to live in this world? I mean, you know, I think someone mentioned something about, you know, Francis Schaeffer's book, How Then Shall We Live? I think it's a fantastic question.
Mm-hmm.
We are in this world. How am I going to make a difference? Because I want to. I mean, that's what I heard out of the Oscars. Like, people are desiring to make a difference, okay? Well, look, I might not agree with the difference they're trying to make.
Absolutely.
But in terms of it, bring it down to a common denominator of, do I want people to somehow feel loved in a very tough world? Yes, I do. Do I want them to meet a Jesus that I think they will fall head over heels in love with? Yes, I do. Therefore, how do I reflect him in the world around me? How is he that attractive, like, tractor beam that's drawing me in? Is he really that? Or do I just have the home team flags that I want to wave and I'm right, you're wrong, and we're doing better things and you're not? I just sort of feel like the way the culture's been polarized, the dialogue isn't happening as effectually as it could.
No, I'm sure at a national level it isn't, because you have to keep a certain level of angst to keep a certain fundraise. I mean, I've seen that in the advocacy groups that I deal with Bridge Builders. To keep the fundraising flowing in enough to make those advocacy groups work, you have to keep fomenting this fear and angst on the part of your team, whether you're from the left or the right. You've got to keep that group really angry, really fearful at the inroads the other side is making to keep fundraising to work. And I think even some of that we've done in terms of religious stuff of prayer vigils and prayer walks and everything we've tried to do to shape culture. We talked about this a little bit earlier today, Brad, but I think one of the things that we kind of mistake is that the real way we impact the culture is through the power of a transformed life. But that's not something that happens overnight. It's not something you can, you know, do a mailing on and raise money for and do those kind of things. But I think Jesus walked through the culture a different kind of human being. And it opened all kinds of opportunities for him. It was the power of a transformed life. I just read through Acts recently again, and watching how Paul's before governors and kings and going into villages and meeting women who are washing clothes by the river, and just whoever he's impacting, his life is touching people. And he's not got a great strategy. He's not got a great plan. He's not got everybody signed up. He's just living the power of a transformed life. That would impact our culture so much, but it's not a beautiful strategy. It's not something you can say, oh, we can do this by next December.
You can't make that into an event.
No, you can't.
And I think that's perhaps what has been some of the angst I've felt towards so many of the church's efforts. I mean, I've been a part of the big
You mean
stadium.
Organized religion's efforts, right? Because I think the church
our whole terminology deal.
I know.
The dynamic is, I think so oftentimes we're wanting to hold the meeting, the event, the gathering, maybe even the stadium thing, that in and of itself is going to finally be the match strike that turns the tide. And I'm just going, I think there's a failure to understand that, you know what, it is day after day, moment after moment, step by step, that I'm going to have this living out of a power of a transformed life. That's how God is going to gain ground in me. It isn't going to be one fell swoop and it's done.
Right.
And I think if we would embrace that, the way that we can be salt and light in a culture would be powerful. Because I think the agenda that people react to would perhaps dissipate and go away. And perhaps they'd be able to then finally hear what's actually coming out of your life.
Yeah, and the power of a transformed life, I want to underscore this, it's not people acting transformed in the world.
Yeah.
I think even the power of a transformed life could actually put a little pressure on us to act different than we are. And I think what we're talking about by transformity is my relationship with God connects me to him in such a way that shapes the way I begin to think and live in the world. And then people notice that going on in my life. It's not, well, I'm going to act different. I'm going to try and act more loving, because people see through that. I mean, we're the only ones, the actors generally don't see through it, the ones acting. In fact, the word hypocrite that they use for the Pharisees, Jesus talked about them in the Gospels. The word hypocrite is the word for actor. It's someone who's acting a certain way. And I certainly don't think Jesus came to create a generation of actors and actresses who would live in the world acting Christian. I really champion this idea. I heard a presentation at a school board. It was a Christian educators conference a number of years ago. And this lady from Texas, I forget her name, but she spoke about how Jesus dealt with children. And what she said was, I think, breathtaking. She said Jesus viewed kids in such a way that caused him to treat kids in such a way that caused kids to see themselves in a certain way that allowed them to see Jesus' father in a certain way. It was just, and that's not quite exactly, I should say, because I don't remember it all exactly, but I think the fluidity of seeing, gosh, just one man acting. I mean, you always got kids crawling up on Jesus' lap, and you always got disciples peeling them off. Go away, leave the man alone. What I like about that was the simplicity of Jesus' life connected him with people. He wasn't doing children's crusades. He wasn't thinking in those terms. He just let the power of his life communicate with people. And I had such a ball with that, traveling on airplanes and doing the things I do. Instead of getting next to people and which is the old pressure I used to feel, how do I manipulate this conversation so it gets to some Jesus thing so someday they don't look at me from hell saying, you sat by me on the plane and you didn't tell me. All that pressure, which leads to a pretty artificial moment. Now, for me, in fact, I don't want to control that conversation anymore. When I sit down next to somebody I don't know, or even I meet new people, my thought is, I want to get into them. Who are you? Where are you coming from? What's going on in your life? If they ask about me, fine. If they don't, I'm not even worried about that. And so many times, in the naturalness of just getting involved with another life, the Jesus things come up, because that's an important part of my life. It is the center of my life. So it'll eventually come up. But when it does, it's not so artificial. It doesn't have that flaky feel of like, you know, if this plane crashes on final, are you going to go to heaven or hell? It really has the point of really helping this Jesus be available to people. And I tell you what, this is one of the things I am enjoying most about my transition outside the box, is I no longer have a home team to stick flags around for, as you talk about it. I've just got a Jesus that I want to introduce people to. And if we can find a way to do that in the simplicity of living, that's far more effective than making it some kind of act.
Well, it's interesting. You know, the greatest kind of acting out there is simply being yourself. I mean, you know, I think we might want to say, and the Oscar goes to the power of a transformed life, a real one.
Wow.
You know, it's like, I mean, if we're to bring a through line of what's going on, I think what we're tired of is the artificial construct, the attempts, the efforts, the performance side of trying to behave right, when it's not genuinely coming from the who you really are and how God has, at this stage in the game, transformed you to be.
Yeah, and the other side of that, which is the polarization between us and the very people God's asked us to live and love and extend the kingdom to in the world we live in. I think it's that polarization of the home team versus the away team that really keeps that from living like it needs to live.
You know, I look at, you know, people's desire in our culture for tolerance. I mean, okay, I don't want to condone a whole bunch of things I do know to be wrong, or that I do believe that the Bible has definite statement on saying that's not good. I don't want to condone that. But in terms of tolerance, I think what you're really hearing is a cry out of people's hearts saying, I want to be loved, I want to be accepted, and I don't know how to feel that when you're judging me for things I don't even know that I'm championing or not. Right. I mean, I sort of feel like we've perhaps pushed people into having to champion, you know, gay pride, when you're just going like, gosh, what if we met them at a different place? What if we just loved them at a different place? Perhaps it wouldn't come to the parade in the street that I've got to fight for my rights, or that now the Christians are the minority, so we better fight for our rights. And then we get the whole intelligent design debate in school and all. It's going like, gosh, it's like there is a desire that says, I believe people, the real Jesus, if they met him, they would know what it is to be loved. The real Jesus. And it wouldn't be issues about, well, I wonder if he condones my behavior or not. And it doesn't seem to be exchanges.
And the problem with pushing behavior or beliefs is, I wouldn't believe some of the things I believe if I didn't know the Jesus behind them. And so the point is not, we've got to get people convinced this is true, that's a sin, this is that. We've got to get them to the Jesus that makes sense of those other things. And I think that's a step we're leaving out in terms of pushing religion on people or religious values on people. Until they know the God I know, how are they going to want to even live the life I want to live?
Yeah, you think about the power of Jesus' life, being able to walk by a tax collector and say, hey, Matthew, follow me. How did that guy get up and leave his life and follow who? I mean, who did he really know what he was getting into? Absolutely not. but there was something so real there that it was worth leaving, forsaking all to follow. You think of the fishermen, they got their nets full of fish, and Jesus says to them, come follow me, I'll make you fishers of men. And somehow they left the entire greatest catch they've ever got.
They didn't even need it.
On the beach. Yeah. They didn't clean it. They didn't sell it. I mean, I would have at least sold it to somebody. Okay.
Seed money for the mission.
Yeah. And you're just going like, there's something of that that just captures my desire saying, you know what? I don't think the world has heard the gospel presented in the reality that I see it lived out in the gospels. There's something there that captures lives.
And maybe a final capper to that is when Jesus, we met with a producer a couple of years ago that was trying to get us involved in some radio stuff, and he talked about if Jesus were alive today, he wouldn't have chosen 12 disciples. He would have bought 12 TV stations. You remember the conversation?
Yes, I do.
Now, that's a funny look at it. How I responded to it, I said, well, you got to tell me this then. Why, when Jesus goes into Jericho and the streets are lined with people who are wanting to see him, touch him, hear him, the most important thing he can think to do is to go home with one of those. And the worst crook in town, Zacchaeus, he gets an invite to lunch. In fact, Jesus invites himself to Zacchaeus's for lunch. Why is it that Jesus knew that in this moment in Jericho, I could go down to the old stadium and hold a revival with hundreds of people anyway who are lining the streets to see him, or I can go home with one crook and see that transform? And I think what he has to come to is that one transformed life will affect Jericho far more than any sermon he could think to preach down at the stadium.
Wow, that's a good way to say that.
Thanks for traveling with us today on The God Journey. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd appreciate your questions or feedback by email or at our blog at thegodjourney.com. Or you can call 24 hours a day to our comment line at 805-626-4212.